This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of November 27th, here are a few top stories. In the news, across the country, LGBT people say they still face discrimination in many areas of their lives. But when it comes to political representation, their tone is markedly more positive. Nearly two-thirds say their local government represents the views of people like them somewhat or very well. That's according to a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. KJZZ's Will Stone reports on efforts in Arizona to translate that local representation into statewide policy.
More than a decade of advocacy in Arizona schools began for Lori Provost in a coffee shop when she spotted an intriguing blue lunchbox with the letters GLSEN.
I'm like, what is that? I really want to know more about it. She started telling me all about GLSEN.
As in the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. Maddie Edelman was the one carrying the lunchbox. She had recently founded the Phoenix chapter of the advocacy group after moving here in the late 90s to teach at the university.
It was hard to find my people. And there weren't a lot of people talking about LGBT issues at the time.
Over the course of their friendship, they've watched the culture shift in their city, and they've been a part of it, says Edelman, serving on city boards or advocating for policies like Phoenix's non-discrimination ordinance.
Where we're going to see the most change is the local level. So I'm dedicating my time to working with individual schools, individual districts, individual cities, and seeing if we can knit them together.
Edelman and Provost say Arizona is behind on LGBTQ rights. It lacks statewide employment protections, and even prohibits schools from, quote, portraying homosexuality as a positive alternative lifestyle.
I feel like I'm constantly looking, what's the latest bill that they're writing or trying to pass, or what are we going to have to combat? Who am I going to have to call?
But Arizona's two biggest cities, Phoenix and Tucson, are different. For example, Edelman points out both get perfect scores for inclusivity from the Human Rights Campaign.
The city of Phoenix has been a leader because the leaders of the city have made LGBT issues a priority. And that's because the people in the city have appropriately demanded that they do so.
The local level is the gateway for equality.
Neil Giuliano knows firsthand. He served as Republican mayor of the city of Tempe during the mid-90s and came out while in office. He took pro-LGBTQ stances that angered some of his constituents, even leading to a recall vote, which he survived.
It was very divisive for the community from an emotional standpoint. We went through that and came out much stronger and much better on the other end.
Giuliano went on to lead national advocacy groups and says progress comes from the bottom up. Ordinances, appointing people to boards.
LGBT people, especially on a local level, have been much more fully integrated into the life of their community. They're no longer living in the shadows to the extent that they once were. And so their neighbors and their friends and their coworkers, people at church.
That's how Daniel Hernandez waded into politics, by running for his school board at age 21. And over time, he says his constituents, some Catholic and socially conservative, became more receptive.
It didn't matter that I was openly gay, but what mattered was the work that I was doing to represent and the relationships that I'd built.
And that gave him room to make reforms in school policy, like protections for gender identity. It's a different political reality for Hernandez now. He serves in the Republican-dominated Arizona legislature and recently helped launch the state's first LGBTQ caucus.
There is a point where the stuff happening at the local level reaches a nexus where it has to have an impact statewide.
Like when state lawmakers passed a religious freedom bill 3 years ago. After a huge backlash, the governor vetoed it. But fellow LGBTQ caucus member Tony Navarrete acknowledges turning local momentum into statewide change may be slow going.
Whether we get it passed this next coming session or whether we get it passed 2 years from now, we are developing a roadmap of how we are going to make sure that Arizona is more inclusive.
And Navarrete says the fact that a roadmap's beginning to take shape, no matter how winding, is progress.
Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now let's hear about one of America's most endangered places that is also here in Arizona. From KJZZ's The Show, here's Mark Brody.
It appears there's a plan for a building that in the past has been identified as one of America's most endangered historic places. The Mountain View Officers Club at Fort Huachuca in Sierra Vista is one of the last two remaining clubs that served African-American soldiers and officers during World War II. The facility of Fort Huachuca was built in 1942. Chris Morris is field director for the L.A. office of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And Chris, what's the plan?
It is a really special building in and of its own right, but also just in terms of military history. And at Fort Huachuca, there was actually a completely separate cantonment that was built for the African-American soldiers who were being trained there of about 1,400 buildings. This was a massive effort. But at that time, in 1941-42, the U.S. military was still segregated. And so they had to build separate facilities. And so this is one of the last remaining buildings from that cantonment at World War II. So it's a really important piece of our American military history and also African-American history in our country. And it was originally designed as a club, so it was a space for entertainment, for meetings, for dinners and kind of live events. And that's very much what we're recommending it be reused for. It was served that purpose very well in 1942 and all the way through the 1960s and into the 1970s. And our market research showed that there is a real need for that kind of facility. And it's very well designed to do that. So we said, you know, let's not fight it. Let's put it back into the use that it was really designed for and that there's still a need for.
What kind of shape is the building in now, both inside and out?
It's a little bit rough around the edges, but it is an incredibly solid building. It has, you know, suffered over the years. There have been a number of modifications, but it's basically quite solid. And what we're talking about doing is just making some minor modifications to the interiors in order to make them function sort of for 21st century dining, restaurant, bar, meeting functions, and then doing a full restoration of the exterior to its 1942 appearance. And then some major alterations that we're thinking about are additions. They're very sensitive, though. Everything would be done kind of to the Secretary of the Interior standards so that they would all be very appropriate. But one of the main things that we're talking about doing is adding a large deck space to the exterior so that you can almost double the usable space, make it much more flexible, and also take advantage of the beautiful views, the mountain views, and the great Arizona weather that you have.
Do you have a cost estimate as to what this might run?
Yeah, I mean, it is. We're talking about four different phases of development over time. The piece that would focus solely on the buildings and sort of the immediate grounds is in sort of the $4.5 million range.
Is that money that you would have to raise? I mean, is that money that the Army would help kick in? I mean, where would that money come from?
That is money that would need to be raised, although we are also hoping that the Army can make some contributions towards that in the form of helping with infrastructure, roads, site development. But yes, the actual funding for the building rehabilitation itself is money that would need to be raised. And we are actively working on that with the rest of our team and a big group of partners. One of the first steps that we have taken towards that is to apply for the National Park Service's African American Civil Rights Fund. So we have, in partnership with the Arizona State Park System, they have applied for $500,000 capital grant, which we all have our fingers crossed that we will receive. And that would allow us to probably complete the full restoration of the exterior if we are fortunate enough to receive that grant.
What has it been like working with the Army on this? Because, you know, the Army has a very specific mission and historic preservation is not really necessarily a huge component of that, whereas that is a really big part of your mission. So did you find that the two sides or the two groups were sort of on the same page as far as wanting to preserve this building and how you wanted to preserve this building?
Initially, I would say we were not on the same page. The National Trust and some of our Arizona preservation partners initially came to this project because we were on opposite sides of the issue with the Army. At the time, several years ago, the Army was really looking at demolition as the alternative for this property, largely because they did not have any use for it identified and they did not have any funding available for it. And so we took upon it ourselves the task of really showing them that that was not the case, that there is, in fact, not only a series of uses for this building, but there's a real need for this building, and it could serve very well some of the needs that we have identified, both on post and off. So we took it as our charge, rather than sort of, you know, saying, no, you need to figure this problem out yourself. We said, let us work with you as a partner to help you figure this out. make sure that it's something that's useful to you, that is sustainable over the long term, and that it also brings benefit to Fort Huachuca, that it's not just about, you know, saving a building, but it's about reactivating it in a way that's sensitive to the legacy, that's sensitive to the history, and hopefully has a really bright and useful new future on the fort.
Chris Morris is the field director in the LA office of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Chris, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was my pleasure.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In business news, the economy in Arizona and the U.S. continues to thrive. KJZZ's Mark Brody talked with one of the leaders of the Federal Reserve.
Arizona's unemployment rate was 4.5% last month. The national one was a little lower than that. My next guest says that means the U.S. has essentially reached full employment with a jobless rate of about 4%. John Williams is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco and was in the Valley yesterday to speak at an economic forecast event sponsored by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. Williams joins me. And John, even though the economy seems to be in pretty good shape now, what do you look to as potential warning signs that things might be starting to take a turn for the worse?
Right. So when you look back over history, there typically are signs when the economy is getting out of balance, is the way I think of it. And so if you look back in the mid-2000s, you know, of course, we had the huge housing boom, which hit this area really, really hard. But we've seen other periods where inflation takes off or other signs that the economy is out of kilter. So, you know, that's kind of, I look at, you know, over history, what are the different signs that we look at, including look at stock market, housing market, inflation measures and things like that. And right now, quite honestly, things don't look that out of balance. Things like look like they're in very good shape. None of these things are sending off any warning signals today.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think that we've gotten a better balance to this economic recovery today than we had, say, 12 years ago. If you think about the U.S. economy in 2005, if you think about it like as a car engine, it was really running on off a couple cylinders. And one of them that was running very hot was the housing market. Today, the housing market still is good. It's improving. But we're seeing consumer spending on a good track. We're seeing business investment. And we're actually seeing the global economy improve, too. So I feel like we're running on more cylinders with maybe a more balanced economy.
Do you feel that there's a disconnect between some of the economic indicators that economists look at to determine whether or not the economy is doing well or not, and the way that people who are not economists feel about how maybe their personal economy is doing?
Well, I do think that. And of course, one of the issues that comes into that is that there's a lot of, you know, it's not one economy. There's, I think of it as there are literally thousands of microeconomies around this country. It's a very diverse country. And even in the Western region, we have a lot of different microeconomies. The other thing is you know, we've had this big increase in income inequality across the United States. And so for some people, things are going really well. Wages, salaries are growing rapidly, and others not so much. So from my point of view, an important part of my job is to go around to different parts of the 9 Western states that I represent for the Fed, talk to different people in different communities, hear what's going on, so I get a full picture of what's happening.
Let me ask you a little bit about your employer, the Federal Reserve, and there will be a new chairman. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think it means for Janet Yellen to be leaving. I mean, does that matter in terms of policy, in terms of leadership, style, structure at the Fed?
Well, I think that Janet Yellen's done an absolutely fantastic job at the Federal Reserve throughout her long tenure there. But I am confident that Jay Powell, assuming that he's confirmed by the U.S. Senate, will step right into that role and do a great job as our next chairman of the Federal Reserve. I think my own perspective is it's more about continuity and building on the success that we've had in recent years of getting the economy back on track. It's not really going to be about a change in direction. Obviously, it's different personalities, different approaches, but I think he'll do a great job.
The Fed has been so, I guess, in the news, for lack of a better word, over the past several years as the country has come out of the recession and tried to get out of the recession. And it seems like what you guys do has been more under the microscope, more maybe in the spotlight. I'm wondering, is that a comfortable position for you to be in? I mean, would you rather be maybe a little more anonymous and just sort of do your work? And not that you're trying to hide anything, but maybe that, you know, each of the big meetings isn't covered by, you know, hordes of media members.
Well, I think that the world has changed. I think that in the past, back in the day, the Federal Reserve was able to operate behind the scenes and not get as much attention. I think in the world of social media and expectations in our democratic society is that we play an important role in our economy and our society, that we need to be open and transparent. And with that comes a lot of reporting on what we do, a lot of questions about what we do. And I think that's actually appropriate. I think it's a good thing.
Do you see the role of the institution changing at all going forward?
Well, you know, it's interesting because throughout the history of the Federal Reserve, there have been a lot of proposals to change its structure, its format and things. I actually think, it's a unique organization where we have the 12 Federal Reserve banks, the Board of Governors, and all of that. I think it works well. I think it gives us very good perspectives from around the country. But of course, you know, these are decisions that are made by Congress and the administration. So we'll see if there's any change. Right now, I don't anticipate major changes to the Fed's kind of how we do things. Structure.
Has the fact that the world and the world's economies have become so interconnected changed the way you do what you do?
It has. I mean, if you think about monetary policy maybe decades ago, you could really think about the U.S. economy as like an island. Today, when we think about the economy, we obviously understand that it's a global economy with trade around the world. Companies outsource or production or, you know, countries, over 100 countries around the globe. Also, our financial markets are really tightly connected. So we spend a lot of time studying what's happening around the world, thinking about what risks there are, and thinking about our decisions in the context of a global financial system.
In one of your earlier speeches that I read, you quoted a very old phrase about when France sneezes, Europe catches a cold, and you related it to, you know, when the U.S. sneezes, in many ways, the rest of the world catches a cold when the economy is in a problematic spot. Mm. Do you find that still to be the case? Is the U.S. still the global economic leader that it has been for years and years and years?
Well, you know, the world is changing. Obviously, China has become a much more dominant economic entity in the global system. But nevertheless, as we've learned over and over, the U.S., and especially the U.S. financial system, is still the center of the global financial system. The dollar still is a central currency in the global trade and global finance.
I want to ask you about something that a colleague of yours at the Fed has been talking about recently, which is cryptocurrency like Bitcoin and the possibility of that maybe gaining traction. Maybe the Fed would have some oversight role over that potentially at some point. What do you make of cryptocurrency as a potential more mainstream kind of way to pay for things?
Well, it's a fascinating question. It's something that we're following in the Federal Reserve, and I'll tell you, my colleagues around the world are following this very carefully, too. Right now, what we're seeing is the underlying technology behind these currencies are now being developed and researched for lots of different uses in the financial system and in the economy. In terms of an actual digital currency, I think it's kind of a fascinating question. Right now, we're not, you know, actively pursuing that. But I think down the road, I wouldn't be surprised to see some governments or central banks think about either adding to or maybe supplanting paper currency with government or central bank issued digital currencies that, you know, literally electronic dollar. I don't see that happening in the very near future, but it'll be really interesting to see whether, you know, 5-10 years from now, we're seeing a movement further and further away from paper currency and checks and things like that to much more efficient digital based currencies.
Do you think that could happen in the U.S.?
I think it could happen in the U.S. at some point. Again, it's not something we're actively looking at now. But I know, you know, I live by nearby Silicon Valley. There's a lot of really innovative thinkers. There are people in other countries who are working hard on that. And I think that, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll probably see some serious proposals about how that could be done.
John Williams is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. John, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
In science news, city lights drive back the night a little more each year, disrupting ecological cycles. From the Arizona Science Desk, Nicholas Gerbis reports how energy-efficient lights could be making light pollution worse.
Earth's total artificial light at night brightened by at least 2.2% each year from 2012 to 2016, most notably in South America, Africa, and Asia. So says satellite research published in last week's Science Advances. Co-author Franz Hölker of the Leibniz Institute of Freshwater Ecology and Inland Fisheries says these lights place unprecedented stresses on plants and animals, including humans.
It threatens biodiversity through changed night habits, such as reproduction or migration patterns of many different species, insects, amphibians, fish, birds, bats, and other animals.
The switch from orange-yellow sodium lights to bluish-white LEDs worsens the problem. Blue light scatters farther in the sky and is more harmful to insects and mammals. Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Education Desk, high school students with trade skills like carpentry, welding, and electrical work are in high demand these days. Some Valley contractors are so desperate for qualified employees, they're offering many kids both a job and funding for college as soon as they graduate. And as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, all that opportunity is starting to catch kids' attention.
There's always something going on in William Schoolcraft's construction class. Today, his students are getting ready for a school-wide garden festival where they can sell some of their garden boxes, chairs, and benches that they've made this semester.
We do all facets of construction. We do roofing and electrical work, plumbing work. Our students will do some welding this year.
Schoolcraft works at Metrotech in Central Phoenix. It's his first year at this vocational public school, and he says so far, two things have surprised him about this job: the dedication of his students, and the large industry demand for them once they graduate.
I weekly am getting calls from companies around the state that are just trying to recruit students out of this classroom.
And that demand isn't just here in Phoenix. According to a recent survey from the Associated General Contractors of America, about 86% of contractors nationwide are having a hard time finding the skilled workers that they need. But it's not just employer demand that's increasing.
My name is Manuel Espinosa. I'm a senior, and I'm also taking construction here at Metrotech High School.
Espinosa is one of a growing number of high school students in Arizona who are enrolling in career and technical education courses. In 2017, enrollment topped 305,000 students. That's according to the Arizona Department of Education. That's more than double the enrollment just 5 years ago. For Espinosa, it's classes like these that led him to pursue an entire career in the industry.
After high school, I want to go to a university and get a bachelor's in civil engineering, which also has to do with construction.
There you go, just a little bit every time.
This is not just for men.
Adults who have already graduated, like Michelle Graves, are also turning to vocational schools in growing numbers. Today, she's learning how to braze a copper pipe in a refrigeration class at the Refrigeration School Incorporated location in Phoenix.
It's Phoenix, so you know anyone that can be an HVAC installer or repairer, there's plenty of openings for that. We probably have an 87% placement rate.
Mary Kelly is the CEO of Stratatech Education, the parent company of RSI. It specializes in skilled trade education for adults.
We're actually having a record year this year.
Bill Simons, the director of the Global Pathways Institute at Arizona State University, adds this increased student interest is part of a larger trend.
I think we've seen the beginning of a really dramatic cultural shift over the last 5 years.
But he says despite the shift in attitude towards skilled trades,
I think Arizona, unfortunately, is lagging behind many other states in terms of what they're doing.
For example, state education budget cuts have restricted CTE courses to just juniors and seniors. Still, he says, if student enrollment trends show us anything, it's that attitudes towards these careers among the general public are definitely changing. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from the KJZZ Fronteras Desk. 3 decades ago, Gallup, New Mexico was known as Drunktown, USA. For many years, it ranked number one nationally in the number of alcohol-related deaths. The community, which borders the Navajo Nation, has worked hard to save lives and change its image. From the KJZZ Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports there's still work to be done.
McKinley County Commissioner Genevieve Jackson grew up on the edge of the Navajo Nation, not far from Gallup. Like many Navajos, Jackson's mother came to Gallup to buy alcohol. Jackson says her mother often wound up passed out on the streets.
Whenever it was announced on the radio that an unidentified woman's body was found, I was just in fear. It was almost a relief that it wasn't her, but then another body would be found.
The Navajo Nation prohibits the sale of alcohol. But Jackson says that doesn't stop Navajos from buying from bootleggers or drinking in border towns like Gallup. This time of year, community service aides drive around Gallup looking for people who are at risk of freezing to death. In the 80s, the police were tasked with picking up people like Jackson's mother. The majority of their shift was spent saving people who'd drunk themselves unconscious. They'd pick up as many as 200 people a day and bring them to the drunk tank, as it was called. It had a cement floor and a drain. Kevin Foley says people took turns sleeping on the floor.
In the morning, they would open up this big garage door, and whoever could walk out, there'd be a big, long parade of people walking down to Cole Street,
where there are several bars or liquor stores to choose from. Today, Kevin Foley says they come here to Natnahoji, a detox center where they're given a bed, food, and counseling for up to 3 days. Foley is the executive director of NCI. With 26,000 admissions every year, it's the nation's busiest treatment center, with many repeat customers. And that's 10,000 fewer people than the drunk tank had 3 decades ago. When someone is serious about quitting booze, they check into the residential program across the street. That's what Freddie Smith Jr. did. He's been sober 8 months. Smith, who is Navajo, says he started partying as a teenager and quickly became an alcoholic and meth addict on the reservation.
There's no real opportunities or anything. I just kind of just lost hope, I think. Nothing big to look forward to, and I started drinking regularly.
Half of the tribe is unemployed. Native American youth have the highest rates of alcoholism of any racial group in the country, according to the National Institutes of Health. Studies suggest high rates of addiction in Indian country stem from 2 centuries of cultural destruction and violence. After Smith stole a car and hit bottom, he told his probation officer he was ready to get sober. He came to NCI, where they have medicine men on staff. They use traditional Native American methods like drumming, sweat lodge, and tobacco ceremonies.
Yes, it's kind of like a form of meditation and prayer. There's a lot of power behind those songs and prayers, and hits you deep inside.
The detox center was the result of a major group effort in 1989. After a string of fatal alcohol-related accidents, more than 200 people got together and marched from Gallup to Santa Fe to ask state lawmakers for help. David Conejo led that effort. Today, he's the hospital CEO.
The people in the street, we can step over them, or we can do something about it.
The march worked. Gallup received enough federal funds to open NCI, $400,000 from the Indian Health Service. Gallup also changed its laws. No more drive-up liquor store windows, no liquor is sold on Sundays, and McKinley County became the first county in the state to approve a liquor excise tax that provides $600,000 a year for abuse prevention and education. Today, Freddie Smith Jr. is an artist and a behavioral health tech for NCI. He brings people into detox, pats them down for weapons or contraband, and shows them to their bed.
I tell them, you know, hey, I was heading the same, you know, the same path you were, and look where I'm at. I'm not, you know, oh, you think you're better than me? I said, no, it's not. It's just, you can help yourself. It's all up to you. If you need help, instead, ask for it. Don't be afraid. Because that's what I was doing. I think I was afraid.
Since the 80s, the number of people freezing to death has dropped significantly in McKinley County. But the number of alcohol-related deaths, both diseases and accidents, is still 3 times the national average. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.